listening to the State of Sustainability, a podcast that highlights sustainability initiatives throughout the state and develops a casual conversation about environmental stewardship that the average person can understand and replicate. I'm your host, Caleb Powell.
And I'm your co-host, Ashley Cabrera.
So today on the pod, we are going to be talking about recycling. I know we talk about recycling quite a bit and all the different types of recycling, but more specifically, this month, we're going to be talking about special recycling. So stuff like wood, shingles, tires, things that are a little bit more difficult to recycle, and there's sort of different ways to do it. We're going to be highlighting Rockwood Sustainable Solutions, an amazing company out of Lebanon, Tennessee, and then just the impacts that they are making in the state when it comes to these special recycling.
Yeah, and I know we've worked with Lincoln Young, the owner and operator of Rockwood Sustainable Solutions, for a while now. But as I was actually preparing to interview him, I realized just how much they actually are doing beyond what I even knew. And I'm excited to talk through the growth that they've had since, 2014, and how they're really helping keep so many types of waste out of the landfill.
Yeah. So Lincoln Young, if you guys don't know who he is, he, in my opinion, is just like one of the powerhouses of recycling here in the state, especially the Middle Tennessee area. He's going to get into, in this episode, get into sort of how Rockwood Sustainable Solutions started, what it was before that, and sort of how he got his start in the recycling world. But he's also the president of the Tennessee Recycling Coalition, and I just really look up to him and all the work that he's done, not only for our state, but just for, the way that people think of these special materials that are hard to recycle. Very specifically, I'm talking about shingles. In my opinion, he's changed really how we think about shingle recycling, at least here in Middle Tennessee.
Yeah, and it really takes a special person to want to deal with some of these wastes, as you'll, I'm sure we'll talk about, some of the wastes he's told me over the years, like, this is really difficult. I don't recommend this, but it's got to be done. So the fact that, you can tell he has a passion for, making sure that those materials are taken care of and not sent to the landfill.
All right, and we are very excited to introduce our guest for this month, Lincoln Young. How are you doing today, Lincoln?
I'm doing great.
It's good. Lincoln's actually been on the podcast before, so a lot of you have noticed last month we had a second or a third time podcast guest, so I think that's pretty cool having guests on for multiple times. It shows that not only are they paving the way, but they've got other projects and programs going on. So Lincoln, we're excited to have you on, and if you don't mind, we'd like to just hear a little bit about you and how you got to where you are.
I'm Lincoln Young. I'm the owner of Rockwood Sustainable Solutions, and we are based out of Lebanon, Tennessee, and we handle a whole lot of different products, but we really started in shingle recycling. So just a little about me. I graduated from Tennessee Tech in Cookeville. Lived up there, married, and have two boys that are twins that are nine. And so that's really life outside of work. For work, kind of a little bit of our background is we got started in the shingle recycling business. So I grew up in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. My mom was in construction, did custom residential homes. And worked with her for years. And when the economy kind of crashed out in 2008, I got into the roofing business. And about that time, we had two big major hail storms. And there were some guys that came in from other parts of the country and set up and started collecting shingles. But they did it without permitting and illegally. And after the hail storms were over, they left town. And at that time, I was in the roofing business, and I thought, hey, there's a need for us to do this and do it right. I got out of the roofing business and started ground up recycling, which was shingle recycling. And then really kind of grown it from there.
Awesome. Yeah. And so my first question for you, Lincoln, honestly, you might have already sort of answered with your little intro, but my first question was going to be, what started your passion for the work that you do? And then, like, what led you to start the path that is now Rockwood Sustainable Solutions? So we heard you talk about really the idea and the build out of your company came from the need that you saw with a material that maybe doesn't get recycled as much as it should. So can you sort of maybe tell how it moved, how your company moved from ground up recycling to what it is now, Rockwood Sustainable Solutions?
Yeah, for sure. So when we first got started, again, it was just shingles. And at that time, we were coming out of the roofing business and had partnered with a large paving company in Tennessee. So what we were doing was we were collecting, cleaning, and processing the shingles, and then we were selling it to the paving company to put into hot mix asphalt. And so that went really well, and really started moving a lot of product across Middle Tennessee. And so then from there, where we really started growing was we were working on, I go back to one of those historical piles. So one of these piles that was collected by another recycler, we were cleaning up, and it was in the city of Lebanon. And so we were working with the city and trying to get this pile that was collected without permitting taken care of. And so when we did that, they wanted to bring in, the city wanted to bring in a gasification plant. And so they purchased a gasification plant from Aries Clean Energy. And we went in and became the feedstock collector and processor. So what we originally were going to do is we were going to process shingles and process a little bit of wood for the gasification plant for the city. And I'll talk a little more detail on the wood collection side here in a moment, but really where that started with a very small focused plan of a few tons, but it's grown now to be a lot more all-encompassing plan where we now handle, you know, shingles, wood, of a lot of different types and variety, to make a fuel as well as mulch, animal bedding, and other products, and then now also handle a lot of other hard to handle waste items such as tires, you know, bulk mix C&D, and different things like that.
That's actually a good segue into my question, which was to tell us about the materials you accept and then the hardest material and the easiest material you feel like, so the hardest and easiest to process.
Materials that we accept now are wood, shingles, tires, and then construction and demolition materials, mainly construction materials. And so with that, what our business is doing is, I would tell you, kind of break us down into really two sectors. We've got the wood that's coming in that we recycle and process, and then we have all these mixed loads. And what we've decided to do is really focus on taking in mixed construction materials, like wood and plastic and cardboard and stuff that comes in off construction jobs. And then we set up to sort those things. So because we're sorting those materials, we're handling a lot of materials like cardboard and plastic and, you know, PVC, just odd and end things that come in from these boxes. And our goal is to try to reduce the amount of material that we're taking to landfill as much as possible. So to answer your question, for us, by far the hardest material for us to process is tires. And tires are, they're something that we handle and they're something that we're working across the state with now. But for us, they are extremely difficult to process because they're the ones that they're just difficult. They're all these different sizes, and they're made not to break down. So it takes a whole lot of equipment and a whole lot of high dollar machinery to work with them. So that's something that is by far our hardest material to process.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard you talk a time or two about tires, and you do them and you do them well, but I know, you know, they're not your favorite thing in the world. but we appreciate that you do, you know, make a point to keep them out of the landfill, because it really is, I think, a bigger problem than most people realize.
Right.
Yeah. And so, yeah. I was looking at your website, Lincoln, and, I wanted to say, or ask you, you know, from your point of view, sustainably, what impacts have you been able to make through, Rockwood Sustainable Solutions and the materials you collect? So I pulled up, and you know, just on your website, it says in the last 5 years, your organization has recycled over 250 million pounds of material. And so all of that, I'm assuming, is just a sum of all the different materials that you talked about right there. And then also, like, there's some more metrics that say Rockwood has kept over 125,000 tons of materials out of the landfill, in all different types of capacity. So those are some, you know, definitely heavy hitting sustainability impacts that you have. But is there anything else that you sort of wanted to touch on when it comes to?
I think. Sorry about that, Caleb. I just cut you off.
No problem.
The biggest numbers that I'm proud of on our company is we've really tried to focus on the hard to handle materials. So before we started shingle recycling, there really wasn't a shingle recycler in the state that was doing what we did or doing it well. And shingle recycling is tough. And that one has caused, you know, it really hasn't grown much. There's a lot of factors around that. But the folks that we got into shingle recycling using it as asphalt still are. And so each year we're probably moving, you know, 10 to 15,000 tons of shingles across Middle Tennessee's roadways. And it's kind of becoming one of those things that is so common with these larger asphalt producers, it's really not even thought about anymore, which in some ways I think is cool, because that was a very problematic material. Now, we don't have 100% of the shingles in all the area coming out of landfills, but a lot of them are being recycled because of those efforts. So that is great to me. I think that's a fun one. The other thing on the wood side is we didn't really go after what your typical mulch producer will go after or what the pallet producer would go after. So the way I would go into a facility is I would say, listen, if you've got good pallets that can be recycled, don't come to me. And I would give them a list of recyclers that did good pallets. And I would tell them, if you have really good green wood or something of that nature that could go for better use, like compost or something of that nature, you know, we moved some of that to where it was supposed to go. Where we fell in was we fell in this mode of handling things that were otherwise going to the landfill. So we never really took materials from fellow recyclers out of their pockets. We typically would go and kind of focus on the things that people were struggling with because it had metal on it, or because it was a different type of wood, or because it was too big or too small, and so it was all going to landfill. And that's really where we focused. And so we were able to take in things like crating and boxes and stuff that maybe had some metal on it. And we have the staff that's going to sit there and sort those things. So to me, those are the big numbers that I'm proud of, because as much as we've grown now, they're not, those numbers are getting pretty significant. And so it is putting a pretty good spotlight into being able to say, hey, we've made a little bit of a sustainable difference over the last several years in what we do. So, and we've done it in a way where we're not just coming in and direct competing against someone else in the recycling business. Cause I'm a big proponent in working together in partnerships with both counties and municipalities as well as other recyclers, because we all have to kind of be in this thing together with recycling, because it's just not one of those that that you can work where you just try to control a market. It's just a little bit different mentality there. So
yeah, I love that, Lincoln. It's something that I never really thought of. You know, you were being very humble there, but you essentially sort of changed how shingle recycling, especially here in our region, is done. And it's more of just like something that, you know, it's the way of life now. Like when, so, you know, you sort of change that, and you don't really get that kind of change without doing some sort of policy work. So seeing it from, you know, you as a case study, or as a, you know, really in the operation side of showing, hey, this is how things should be, and this is how things can be. So really sort of changing people's mindset on where shingle should go. So that's pretty neat. I really appreciate, and I never really thought about it until we started talking about that right now, but you've changed the way people think about shingles.
I agree. I mean, you know, I didn't know exactly how that would work or that it would change that mentality, but in a lot of ways, and again, it's hitting statewide, but especially in Middle Tennessee, it really has. I think that's cool, because it's almost changed it to the point now that it's just a way of doing things, which ultimately I think is how all of recycling typically goes, you know, even down to going back into thinking about curbside recycling or someone doing cardboard and stuff. You know, you've got probably a generation of folks that, you know, they're growing up going, how would you even think about not recycling your cardboard? So it's becoming more of a commonplace of like, okay, this goes here, this goes here. And that was done a little bit with shingles. And so to me, I think that's a big one that I, you know, I'm proud of for sure.
So going off of shingles, just with the little bit of knowledge I have, I was hoping you would go more into detail. I want to, you touched briefly on the gasification project that you've been doing with the city of Lebanon. And I've actually been able to go out and see it. It's really cool, neat project. Can you explain like all the materials involved, the purpose of it, just kind of what goes into it, just from like a, you know, 30,000 foot view, because I know there's a lot of detail that you could give on it, but just 30,000 foot view.
On the gasification side?
Yeah.
Yeah, so really the big detail there is the city is the owner of the gasifier. Aries Clean Energy, or Aries Green, is the operator of the gasifier, and they're the ones that built the machine, and then we supply the feedstock for it. So for us, our role is to handle the collection of the materials and then to prep those materials and get them ready for the feedstock. So when we first started, that was the only place we were sending wood. And so what we would do is we were trying to screen this material and pull out the and pull out the fines, and we were struggling with that to the point that what we decided to do was we decided to change a few things, open up our screens, and start making mulch. And that's really where things really took off for us, because we were then able to make two products. And so the gasification chip, or the fuel for the gasifier, kind of became a byproduct of what we were doing on the mulch. So that shifted our mentality of prepping materials and utilizing equipment to make kind of the best outcome. So just to kind of give you that high level view of what we do is we take that wood, we send it over to the gasifier. What the gasification is you're in essence burning, but you're not giving it oxygen. So it's not incineration. It's not burning. You are putting heat to the wood, but you are not allowing it to combust. So if you think about building a fire, you have to have heat, a fuel or feed source, and then you have oxygen. So if you're burning leaves in your backyard or whatever, oxygen is one of those critical components to making a fire. So we pull the oxygen out, and what happens is now basically you're taking that wood and you're doing a chemical reaction. And so the wood has a lot of heat on it, so it's trying to combust, but because it doesn't have the right amount of oxygen, it is pulling a gas off, which is called a syngas, which is very clean. It's just as clean, if not cleaner, than natural gas. And so then you're lighting that gas in another unit. So you pull that out of the wood, you pull that out of the gasifier to what's called a thermal oxidizer. You light that that gas, which is running a boiler, which is making, the boiler is making steam, which then goes into these organic Rankine cycle generators that makes electricity. And so that's what happens to the gas. And then the really cool thing is once it leaves that gasification chamber, now if you think about, you know, a wood molecule, wood is typically breathing in carbon dioxide. So it's giving off all its oxygen. And now all you're left with is carbon. And that's called biochar. Or, you know, some people call it biocarbon. And so that material is then, we don't have much of a direct line of that material. But Aries sells that material over into the building industry. And what they're utilizing it for is to be able to create building products that have embodied carbon or have a carbon sequestration factor to those products, which if you're in much of manufacturing or anything now, you kind of understand that carbon and our carbon footprint and carbon impacts are huge. And so that product and this process really helps with greenhouse gases and kind of pulls that in with some of this carbon sequestration stuff. So that's another really exciting thing for us, because what it allows me to do is on my end, I'm able to get in front of a lot of our folks with the University of Tennessee and the Ag Extension folks who are kind of starting to have these conversations about what to do with this carbon. How can it be used in fertilizer? How can it be used in agriculture, soil growth and development to help with multiple items? So that's an exciting thing there.
Yeah, I haven't been able to, unfortunately, go out and see the gasification plant, but I'd like to soon. And, you know, I think when our listeners are hearing you talk, Lincoln, about your processes and your facility, I think it's sort of hard for, you know, the average person to, if they haven't seen a big recycling facility, to sort of, you know, visualize what that looks like. I'm excited because once we get this episode out, everyone make sure to check our Instagram page that corresponds with this episode, because if you don't mind, Lincoln, I'm probably going to use maybe some of those pictures that Shelby and I took just to get an idea.
Absolutely, that'd be great.
Yeah, and that sort of gives some ideas of, you know, the picture that I might post on there is that one with you in front of the... maybe I'll post the one of you and I in front of the huge pile of wood, and you don't realize how much material a facility like you is bringing in until you see that pile. And so everyone make sure to check out our corresponding Instagram post, because I'll have a couple pictures from whenever I went out and hung out with Lincoln at Rockwood. So, but yeah, you know, I think that's basically all we have, Lincoln. First off, you know how much I appreciate all that you do. It's always great getting to talk to you, and especially having you on the podcast, just because I think, you know, the work that you have done for years and are continue on doing, you know, doesn't go unnoticed for the people that are in that sector, or, you know, that deal with that kind of stuff. But the average person, the average citizen here in Middle Tennessee, or, you know, around the state even, might not realize, you know, all the great stuff that we've got going on. So I'm glad that we can highlight your facility and your organization. And I'm excited to see how you guys expand and how you guys keep, you know, keep things from the landfill moving forward.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate the time on the call, and always enjoy talking to you too. And I know y'all well, and y'all do a lot of great work for the state and a lot of great work for recycling. So I appreciate all y'all do as well.
The Ranger Report, brought to you by the Tennessee State Parks. Fun and adventure, naturally.
All right, the Ranger Report is back this month, and we are super excited to have Ranger Jesse Germerod here from the Cedars of Lebanon State Park. How are you doing today, Jesse?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to have you. I know there's a, at your park, you guys, how many rangers are at Cedars of Lebanon?
We've got 4 rangers and a park manager, so 5 total.
So yeah, I sort of feel like that's... Is that normal? How many rangers are normal? I guess there's no normal because all the parks are different. So I feel like that's a sort of a low number for a state park. But am I wrong there?
No, I think that's pretty typical. I think, and this predates me, but there was only like 3 rangers here for a long time. And then with the transfer of some state land from forestry Tennessee Division of Forestry to State Parks Management, they added another position to help with that addition of land. But there is no normal. It just depends on funding and various other factors. It just depends on the park. There's some parks out there that only have a manager and a ranger, and they might be, you know, 3 times as big as Cedars Lebanon. So there's a lot of factors that go into play and stuff like that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it all depends on what's offered at the park, the facilities that are there, you know, everything. There's just literally so many variables, but...
yeah, definitely.
But I digress from that. So I wanted to... How we always start the Ranger Reports is to get a little introduction of you and sort of how you got to where you are at Cedars of Lebanon. So if you wouldn't mind just diving a little bit deep into who you are.
Okay. Well, I have a great love of natural resources and outdoor recreation and history. And I owe a lot of that to my parents. My dad was a national park ranger, and so we lived in various places all over the country for different amounts of time. And then his dad was a national park ranger, so that was the life he was used to moving around. And my mom was a science teacher, and she taught mostly natural sciences. So that between my father working in parks and us getting to live in pretty unique places, and then my mom's like teaching me the curiosity of learning more about different subject matters, because she was a teacher for many years, that is what like got me curious about being a park ranger. And I really enjoyed watching my dad doing, I obviously didn't know all the things that he was doing, but and I knew it was very hard to get into being a park ranger. And I did try to get in the national park system a couple different times, or many years ago. It was just a different time back then. But I went to school in Nashville at a university, and I majored in environmental science there. And I got a minor, and I had... It's just funny when people go to college, you know, it depends on what year you come in, but all my hard classes were at the beginning of college, which was really hard on me, but I had a lot of extra time the last couple of years in college, so I picked up a history minor because I just love history and I like to read a lot. And I got the opportunity to be an ecology intern. I was technically paid by the university, but I worked at Radnor Lake. And so I did a forest study there at Radnor that had been going on for about 40 years. It hadn't been done in about 10 to 15 years or so. And I worked with a professor out of Penn State that was interested in forest ecology and changing of those environments. And I did some stuff with the park. The park was really open to me doing some programming. I did some trail work with them. And I got invited to come back the following season after I was done with school to be a seasonal interp ranger, is what they called them then. And so I did programming. I did led hikes. I did canoe floats, did trail work. Got to work with the rangers that are there. And that's how I got into parks. And I first started at was Radnor Lake. At the time, it's still designated as a Class 2 natural area. It was Radnor Lake State Natural Area. I think they've rebranded. It's called Radnor Lake State Park, but it's still a natural area at heart. Worked there for nearly 6 years. I took when they opened Rocky Fork State Park, which is in Flag Pond, Tennessee, northeast Tennessee, I interviewed and got the opportunity to go up there and start a brand new park, and had a ranger transfer from Warriors Path, Jim Ferris. He's now the manager there. But I worked at Rocky Fork for a little over five years. It was a great opportunity because you just don't open brand new parks very often. And try to, long-term planning and making good decisions and, things like that. And then after that period of time, I had the opportunity to transfer to Cedars Lebanon into the Ranger 3 position here. I've been here just over 2 years, and so I'm in charge of safety, security, training the rangers and emergency services related things like law enforcement, medical, search and rescue, all that stuff, and keeping them up to speed and trained up. And then I manage the maintenance department and that staff that works out of that operation, and do various other things here because this park's very different from the last two parks I worked at.
Yeah, definitely. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of the park. To be honest with you, Cedars of Lebanon is the park that I have been to most recently. One of my wife, she's a photographer, and one of our friends was getting married there a couple weekends ago. And so we were there all day helping them with everything and shooting the wedding and all that kind of stuff. So
awesome.
It's pretty neat to be able to do a ranger report whenever I was just there. I actually should have brought the mic and just done it while I was there. Honestly, I should have just called you up. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of the park. So can you jump into when it became a state park and then what it was before it was actually classified as a state park?
Yes. So Cedars Lebanon is located in Wilson County, and it's surrounded by Cedars Lebanon State Forest. It gets its name from the eastern red cedar found throughout the park, which is early American settlers that came here thought it seemed like the famous biblical cedar forest that's at Mount Lebanon, which is near the Mediterranean area. The cedar trees here are technically not actual cedars, they're actually a juniper. But so that's where it gets its name. It started as a park in 1950. It was established as a state park in 1955. But prior to that, this is one of the parks, there's several in the state that are considered the WPA era parks, Works Progress Administration parks. So in the New Deal and the era where there was a lot of strife and a lot of things going on in our America's history, a lot of young people and different age folks were in the CCC program, and they were learning skills and building masonry and building stuff out of local resources. And sometimes they're building parks. Cumberland Mountain is another example of a CCC park in WPA era. So we have a lot of we have some structures that didn't make it all the decades, but we have several signature structures that still exist from that era that was built by the CCC and the funded through the WPA. And it's our Sierra Forest Lodge, which is more of a, ends up being more of a wedding venue, I think, most times, but there's meetings that happens out of it. And then we have a shelter and a picnic table, and then there's the superintendent's house that they built for the first, when the park first opened up. And I actually lived in that house for a little while when I first moved here. And since then, it's been renovated. It's going to be an archive set up run by Mr. Hobart Aiken. But the what makes this place special, beyond the history of the WPA and the CCC and all that, cedar, so ecologically, it's very significant here. Between the park, the state forest, and the state natural area, Cedars 11 State Natural Area, and there's several other natural areas within about 15 miles of here. It is the largest contiguous cedar glade habitat in the world. So
wow.
There's several species that exist in these different phases of cedar glades. Anything from a karst opening, which is like a limestone opening where it's nearly just rock, to a very thin soil profile where it supports, cedars do great in dry areas, but it supports very unique species that almost species you'd see, some of their relatives live in arid environments out west. And the reason why they live in these cedar glades, because there's very little water, there's very little moisture. So it's a very harsh desert-like inhospitable habitat that supports this really unique plant communities. And there's about 19 rare and endangered plant species that grow profusely around these cedar glades here in the park and in the natural areas, some in the forest. And then there's several other natural areas within, I shouldn't even say 15 miles, but like 5 to 10 miles, but they're close enough. It's considered a contiguous environment. And there's people that travel from all over the world to come here. And in the 1940s, botanists noticed these unique natural ecosystems, and they call, some places would call it a rock garden, but these are limestone glades. And then there was Elsie Quarterman, who was a professor and researcher out of Vanderbilt. She was a big proponent. She ended up naming them cedar glades. She later in life wished she hadn't, wish she had just called them limestone glades, because it doesn't necessarily need to have cedars around it. But we have an Elsie Quarterman Fest in the spring where several naturalists and botanists come, and we talk about, we do hikes out in the glades, and there's a botanist that comes that has a flower named after him. It's pretty, from a natural aspect, you have that going on. You have the history. And then I've worked all the parks I've worked at before. I named the ones I worked at full time, but I've worked other ones on a temporary basis. And all of them have had standing water on them. This one is, in my opinion, kind of a geologic wonder. It's full of caves and sinkholes. I think there's around 1,000 or so caves/sinkholes. Not all of them people can get in, but they've all been mapped or surveyed. And there's Jackson Cave, which we do ranger-led and seasonal recreator-led hikes into Jackson Cave. And there's other caves we take folks into. They're closed right now for some bat-related stuff. But all our water goes underground. There might not be any standing water, but you'll go into some of these caves with rangers, and there'll be a flowing creek flowing underground. So we've got all that going on, from the natural cultural resources. And then, of course, this place is considered a recreational park in the sense of it's got a campground, it's got playgrounds, rental day use facilities. It's got 8 miles of hiking trails and 5 or so miles of horse trails. And then the forest state, we back up to the state forest, which offers other opportunities, and the state natural area is several 8,000 acres next to us, which is more of a low-key natural area where it's just, you can walk out there. There's some hunting, there's hiking, people walk out there to do botanical and wildflower walks, birding, all that stuff. So there's a lot going on in this place, for especially for being less than an hour's drive from Nashville. And our campground is extremely popular. It's very full most of the time, almost year round, just because of the proximity to I-40 and 840 and being very close to Nashville and really not that far from Cookeville or Chattanooga. So we stay very busy here.
Yeah, and you know, with all of the amenities that you have at the park and the activities that are offered, and you would think that, I just feel like there's so many moving parts. You know, four or five rangers, I feel like, and I'm not one to know how many rangers can take care of a park, but it just seems like, you know, whenever I was there a couple weekends ago, we drove through the campground. How many camp spots do you guys have in the campground?
We have 117 campsites, and all of them have water and some sort of electrical hookup. There's like about seven or so campsites that are like tent only because they can only support basically, like, I've seen people plug coffee pot or plug their charger in or something. But really all of them are really designed for anything, depends on your size and length of the site, but anything from a pop-up camper to some of these very large RVs and stuff like that. And I've seen other things that I don't know if you can even call them RVs, but 117 sites, and some of them, we've got a few of them that are full service in the sense of they have sewage hookups, all different prices, all that stuff.
Yeah,
and then we've got technically 10 cabins that you can rent, that folks can camp, or not, excuse me, can't camp, folks that can rent for overnight stays. We have a cabin that people use for like a bridal suite kind of thing for Cedar Forest Lodge or the Assembly Hall or all these other places you can have weddings at. So lots of overnight accommodations. We don't have any primitive campsites. We do have a group camp, and that's really just reserved for like school groups, church groups, NGOs, or nonprofit 501c3s. That's who we are, and that's kind of separate from everything else. It's somewhere else in the park, and it's just a shelter and it's just open space with a fire pit, and we don't rent it to the general public. It's just a space for folks that want to come, and basically big groups. So usually the folks we see in there are scout groups, churches, sometimes schools, and you know, the like. So
yeah, whenever we were there, I think there's a couple of cabins that are more like rustic, like sort of close to the main like office and the and that's where the bride and groom were staying. And it was, you walk in there and you really do, you got everything that you need, small little kitchen, the bathroom, but it gives you more of the rustic, you know, being out in the woods in a cabin type feeling, rather than the other ones where like all of the wedding party and stuff was staying. Those were in those more like sort of updated, upgraded cabins, which were very, very nice.
They're more of a modern park architecture. And then the one you were talking about previously, they're probably the Ricketts cabin. It's one of our historical cabins. It has a numeric. It's cabin 11, but it's Ricketts cabin's historic. And they did a lot in there to try to maintain that theme of some of the early folks that were here before the park was here. A lot of, I know I'm backtracking a little bit, but in the conversation, but a lot of farmers that were in this area, this was a very poor place have for agricultural use because of the prevalence of these limestone glades and caves and not a whole lot of water. Farmers had a hard time here. There was a big industry for cedar trees, and they would send those for make pencils and other things like that. But a lot of farmers were given basically a deal with the federal government to go to more fertile places. So some of the farmers that were originally here got to go to Mississippi and some other states in the southeast that had more fertile ground, and the government got these tracts of land. There's boundary markers out here where the U.S. Department, USDA and the Forest Service helped design some of the original infrastructure out here before it was a state park. So you'll find markers out here that say U.S. on top of the monuments. So,
well, you know, I didn't realize, and I don't know if this is true or not, but so I live in Murfreesboro, like near the square in Murfreesboro, and mm-hmm. when we drove to Cedars of Lebanon, I didn't realize how close it was to Murfreesboro. You just get on
231,
yeah, and then you're there.
Yeah.
So. And my wife, she, like I said before, she's a photographer, and so I don't think she had ever been there before. And when we got there, she said, "I don't know why I don't do more. I don't know why we don't go here and do more hikes and do more photo shoots and stuff there." And I said, "Well, now you know." And so hopefully this can be an eye opener for any of our listeners out there that, you know, are in the Middle Tennessee area. That because Cedars of Lebanon is a beautiful park, and like you said, it's a quick trip. It's you feel like you're out far away without being too far away, and that's what I think is so unique and just amazing about a lot of our state parks here in Tennessee. Is there's, you know, don't get me wrong, there are quite a bit of parks where you don't have service and you've got to you know, sort of get out into these rural areas to get to, but there's a big handful of our parks that, you know, you could get there and spend the day and get back home, and, you know, all in the same day. So I think that's a big reason for these ranger reports, is to sort of highlight the different opportunities, and, you know, find those parks that are close to you and really
definitely,
you know. So we like to I always like to ask, when you're talking about park size, I always try to put them into categories of small, medium, large, just with, I guess, land area. Where would you say that Cedars of Lebanon State Park falls in those categories?
Oh, man, it's kind of a wide spectrum, to be honest. I would not say we are a small park, because we have several in our system that are below 500 acres or below maybe 200 acres. I'd say we're talking about some big gaps, but I'd say we were a medium-sized park. A lot of parks are around 1,000 acres or so. We're our website will say 1,139 acres, where I think we're actually a little larger than that. We've had some acquisitions in the last few years. And then the natural area, which is also a couple thousand acres, it's managed as a natural area from an ecological standpoint, but the park does a lot of the people management and recreation management out there. So if you include that, we're talking about a few thousand acres. I think we fall in the medium category. And then, you know, we have some very large parks in our system that, formerly South Cumberland State Park, and it's now been split up between South Cumberland and Savage Gulf. But I think before they split up, they were pretty close to that 40,000 mark. And then I know Fall Creek's very large and Frozen Head's large, but I'd say we fall in the medium category. I think there's a lot of parks that are about our size, give or take 1,000 or so acres.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what I've found with my research of the Tennessee State Parks is a majority of them I would classify as of our parks would be in that medium level. I think small ones I normally classify as like the day use, you know, smaller parks like that. And then, you know, you've got your huge ones that you just mentioned right there. But it does sort of get a little hard to classify that. It's sort of, sometimes I don't like asking that. I've just been doing it, so I keep doing it. But because it's sort of hard to classify that, especially with there being natural areas or forests, state forests,
yeah,
right next door. I mean, that's essentially...
Yeah.
Part of that area.
In the state forest, which since that's, I mean, we don't do anything over there. We have a state forestry office literally across from our entrance, and the foresters out of there, we have a great working relationship with them. They do stuff in the forest. They help us with stuff. We try to help them with stuff, but we don't really have anything to do with the forest, but they're at our back door. And I will say, this is something I've experienced in other parks. From the local standpoint, and I'm not considered a local, I'm not from here, from the local vernacular, like people call this area Cedar Forest. They don't call it Cedars Lebanon State Park. They call it Cedar Forest. And when they're talking about Cedar Forest, they're talking about the whole thing. They're talking about the forest, the state park, and even the natural area out there. And it's really hard. We do a lot of education to educate, like, there is a difference between all these different entities. It is very, it can be very confusing for somebody that doesn't work in the system. But, like, the park, the forest is separate from us, from the park, and the natural area is technically, you know, it's just a lot.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And there's other parks that are like that as well. Like, I think it's a good example of that. It's a large park, and it has also the forest next to it. So it's just some shared responsibility. Some of the same mission. We have some similarities, but we're doing different things. But yeah.
Yeah, I think that's important to bring up, and I'm glad you did in these ranger reports, because I think a lot of people just have this idea that, you know, a state park, you know, I don't really know, since I've been a part of the state park system for so long. It's hard for me to think how others do, but I think it's really necessary to sort of realize the differences in, you know, who's over it, where the funding comes from, stuff like that. Even though it might not matter to a lot of people, it's always good to know that there is differences. Well, cool. I really appreciate it, Jesse, and I can't wait to meet you in person. Since we just talked about this being close to the house, I probably will be bringing my wife out to Cedars of the Lebanon State Park quite a lot more. I know she'll be asking, so next time I do, I'll definitely hit you up and see if I can, you know, meet you in person, and you can show us some cool stuff that maybe don't always get to see.
Definitely. I'd love to show y'all some of the, I mean, if it fits in with y'all's program and your, whatever y'all's, I shouldn't say mission, but like whatever it is that, like, I'd love to show, if it helps y'all out, I'd love to show you a lot of our, stuff we're doing for sustainability here at the park. If it fits in, whatever, or, you know, if you and your wife come, I'd just take y'all on a tour around the park and show you some stuff that I think there's a lot of people that come here. We got a lot of folks that come here just to hike, and they don't go and look at other stuff. And then we try to pull them in with programs, and then there's people that camp here, but you don't see them on the trail. So trying to get these people to cross over some of their maybe even comfort zone is maybe a great way to put it in some ways. But like, I'd love to show you all around in the park, and you can share that information with your friends, and hopefully get more folks out here to enjoy the place.
Definitely,
and
yeah.
Love it the way we love it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really the main reason for these ranger reports, is just to show that a state park isn't just a place to hike, like you said, or it isn't just a place to camp. Like, there's rich history, there's rich, you know, natural areas. Like you were talking about, the biggest glade in the, you said Cedar Glade, or now I don't know what to say, Cedar Glade or
yeah,
you know,
Cedar Glade, that's totally fine.
And I didn't even know that. So there's always something to learn, especially at our state parks. So get out there, check them out. And I can't wait to get out there and meet you in person, Jesse.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks for calling. I really appreciate it.